27. Invite Senator Bryant.
Yeah. Good morning, Mr. Chair, committee. I hope everyone had a good weekend. I think the weather helps. My name is Neil Bryant. I'm Senator from District 27, which is Central Oregon, and I'm using one of my priority bills to bring you Senate Bill 1327. Initially, this bill was going to be introduced by the entire committee, subcommittee of Ways and Means on human resources, and in particular, those dealing with the Oregon Health Plan. And that included Senator Q-Tub, Senator Fisher, Senator Mayee, Senator Shields, and myself. And from the House side, Representatives Strobeck, Ross, and Logan. So you can see it was bipartisan. And what brought this about and the discussion on fluoridation was in the interim, in working on the Senate budget, I had a work group specifically designed to take a look at the Oregon Health Plan. And I was surprised to learn that approximately 20% of Oregonians had fluoride in their water system. And then when Senator Q-Tub took over the chair of the subcommittee on Ways and Means on Human Resources, she continued that work group. And as we've looked at trying to save money for healthcare costs, the thing we can do that will create the most prevention and save the most money is fluoridate water. Dental Association signed up to talk about this, but their comments in the work group is it could save 50% of your dental costs. And in the Oregon Health Plan, which of course covers children through the CHIP program, pregnant moms, and adults dental care, it's over $50 million if you total all the programs up. And even if you eliminate some of those programs, you're still going to have to pay for it because sooner or later it gets bad enough that these individuals show up at the emergency room, and then it really gets expensive. But the bill before you is a mandate, but it's a funded mandate. It says that the state of Oregon will pay for the cost of the chemical and also the one-time cost for the equipment. And for this biennium, it'd be slightly under $4 million. The chemical costs about $900,000 a year, and the equipment, for those who don't have it right now, costs about $2 million. It's a safe process. You can't taste it. It just prevents cavities, which prevent root canals, which make for healthier people and children, especially the children as they're growing up and their teeth are forming. I grew up in an area in Oregon that didn't have fluoride. I had a lot of cavities. I brush regularly. And of course, the toothpaste companies saw out of this years ago, especially Crest, which emphasized fluoride. But you don't get enough by taking it with your toothpaste. And when we raised our children, then we had fluoride drops that we try to remember to put into their cereal or their juice every morning. This would take care of that. I represent two water companies in Bend, one that would be covered by this, the other wouldn't because it's too small. But in speaking to the owner, he said, great idea, he said, put it, though, in a statute, make me do it. And the reason goes back to what a statement my father made in the 1950s. I grew up in Salem, and there was some vote. It was either a referral of a city council issue or someone trying to require it, said, we're going to fluoridate the water, and the people said absolutely no. And the primary reason, my father said, was it was a communist conspiracy, that if you put fluoride in your water, it was a way that somehow your mind would be changed and you'd become fellow travelers or card-carrying communists. And now that the Cold War ended and the evil empire is basically gone, I hope that that's not a reason that's given anymore. One of the last votes that took place on this was apparently in Eugene in the 70s, and it failed. And you would think, if an area that might accept this, it would have been Eugene, but I don't know what the reason was or what the campaign was, but they did not. It's a very small amount that goes in the water, and this bill would provide that the state of Oregon would pay those costs. There might be some changes needed in the bill. As I said, this is a priority bill, so it came out finally out of LC. But the funding portion of this would be some adjustment in the human resource sub, which Chair Keithub knows and supports this, and the goal of that subcommittee, which I served on until about a week ago, was they'll try and find the funding, because we think this is a great prevention tool, and long term will save the state of Oregon tens of millions of dollars in the health of their costs. And also it'll save money for our private insurance companies too, and for us who have insurance, because the premiums should not either increase or might even go down if you have dental coverage. So all good reasons to support it, and I would be happy to answer any questions.
Questions? Any questions?
Thank you very much, Senator.
Call Rick Wilson, Jane Mars, Lynn Ironside.
My name is Rick Wilson. Good morning. I'm a president of the Oregon Dental Association, and I'm here to offer our support for Senate Bill 1327. The Oregon Dental Association strongly supports this bill because we agree that water fluoridation is the most cost-effective, practical, and safe means of reducing tooth decay in our communities. Access to benefits of water fluoridation obviously are not limited to those with access to care. The entire community benefits, and the benefits are realized without any sort of behavior changes, and I think this is critical. The professions of dentistry and dental hygiene have long histories of promoting prevention as a way of reducing decay, but outside of fluoridating water supplies, every method that we promote requires some sort of behavior modification, which requires that the patient end up in our offices. And if they don't end up in our offices, they're obviously not going to modify their behavior, and they're not going to reduce decay. I also want to mention, Senator Bryant mentioned Crest toothpaste and the other toothpaste companies and having latched on to the fluoride issue. You have to remember, as we had this discussion, the difference between systemic fluoride and topical fluoride. A toothpaste is topical fluoride, much as you get in the dental office. And it only coats the outermost layer of the tooth to make it harder. When you fluoridate a community's water supply, that fluoride is taken up in the whole enamel structure of the tooth and makes the entire thickness of enamel more resistant to decay, and that is the key to its effectiveness. A review of studies from 1976 to 87 shows reduction in decay ranging from 15 to 35% in permanent dentition among adults and seniors, up to as much as 60% in baby teeth. And this is really critical once again. Studies continue to show that water fluoridation reduces decay, study after study after study. And the less cavities you have, the less money you're going to have to spend on repairing decay. And in addition to the fact that the citizens of the community suffer less from dental pain, because children from lower socioeconomic groups tend to have more tooth decay, they would benefit the most from water fluoridation. And as we, as you all will have to go back and debate with each other the future of the Oregon Health Plan, any sort of mechanism that we can put in place that will reduce expenditures in the Oregon Health Plan saves money, obviously, for that plan and for other uses. And I think you've come up with a lot of other ways to use the money and continue to. So, the other thing I'd like to mention, the cost-to-benefit ratio is exceptionally good. 50 cents per person per year covers the cost of fluoridation on the average nationally. That's very inexpensive. There are various studies to show that for every dollar spent on public fluoridation of water supplies, there is many, many, many more dollars. It ranges from $50 to $100 savings for every dollar spent on fluoridation. 24% of Oregonians live in communities with water fluoridation. As a dentist, I think that's embarrassing. We need to do more. There was a 1991-93 oral health needs assessment done by the oral health by the Oregon Health Division, and we're in our written testimony. We're submitting some of those numbers here, but I think it's important to note that in children 3 to 5 years old, 26% needed restorative care, needed fillings. Of 6 to 8 years old, once again, 24% needed care. When we go to teen mothers, we're up to over a third, 36% need restorative care. The need for dental services in this state is grave. I mean, access is always a problem. The Oregon Health Plan has helped, but access is and will remain a problem. And any method that we can use to reduce tooth decay will help. The Oral Health Needs Task Force, and I quote, said that in order to improve the oral health status of Oregon residents, steps must be taken to increase access to basic preventive services such as community water fluoridation. Water fluoridation meets every objective. It increases access to preventive service, and it opens the access to every Oregonian who will now live in a water district that serves more than 10,000 people. Public opinion has consistently been in favor of water fluoridation. There is a small but vocal minority that is opposed to water fluoridation. They have always been there, and I think that as this debate continues, you will hear from that minority. I ask you, as you listen to both sides of this debate, I beg of you to remember that one side of this issue bases its conclusions on what I would consider good science, and the other side bases its conclusions on what I would consider and what every other person in the scientific community would consider to be bad science. I urge you to listen to the good science and to do what you need to do to serve the constituents of this state. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions of the witness? Any questions?
We have appended, also I might add, a list of groups that support fluoridation. As you can see, it's quite long. There's one other appendix here, too. It's titled, it's the last page, Key Elements in Reviewing Information About Fluoride Research. I urge you to go over that. It's from an ABA publication on fluoridation, and it's just a few little guidelines to help you get through some of the dental research if you need to get into that regarding fluoridation. Thank you.
There's a bar. Doctor, at what levels does fluoridation become a health risk?
Well over the optimum level is about 0.7 to 1.2. We're getting up into multiples, 3, 4, 5, 6, and there are some areas in Colorado and some of the mountain states that have levels up to 10 parts per million. That's very high. One of the disadvantages of living in an area that has no naturally occurring fluoridation is that most of the residents don't have access to it. The advantage is that you're able to regulate, the level of fluoridation, whereas in some states, I grew up in Texas, there were areas where there was, we call it mottled enamel, occurring. But you have to reach levels many times, well, several times, I won't say many times, higher than what we would be putting in the water here.
Thank you very much. We have a very large schedule this morning, so if you could be brief, I'd appreciate it. We have several witnesses signed up, mostly in favor of fluoridation. Let us know if you have additional information. We'd be pleased to hear from you. Jane?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Jane Myers for the Oregon Dental Association. I just came up to answer any questions, if there were any. And to point out to you, we've given you the American Dental Association's most recent fluoridation facts, and I went over it, and it's pretty descriptive of all the available information that we have on hand today. And with that, I'll turn it over to Ms. Ironside.
Thank you.
Mr. Chair, good morning. Members of the committee, I'm Lynn Ironside, Chair of the Government Relations Council of the Oregon Dental Hygienists Association, and we, of course, do support this bill, and I have nothing more to add.
Thank you very much. Appreciate that. Larry Jacoby? And Willie Tipney. Larry, would you go ahead, please?
Good morning. My name is Larry Jacoby. I'm a practicing dentist at a community health center in Hood River, La Clinica del Carinho, here to speak in support of Senate Bill 1327. And my comments will be brief because Senator Bryant and Dr. Wilson addressed most of the concerns that I wanted to bring up. Just to add on to Senator Bryant's comments about emergency room visits, because in my population, this is a group, my patients are primarily low-income, uninsured, or Oregon Health Plan recipients who tend to have greater needs, greater dental needs, higher decay rates, and more difficulty accessing dental care. And as a result, these are the patients that, because of their inability to access care, tend to wind up in hospital emergency departments where they probably incur a bill of about $300. And at that point, no service is really rendered. For me as a dentist, and seeing these problems on a daily basis, I realize we're never going to treat our way out of these dental decay difficulties. And to me, fluoridation represents the most effective, the most cost-effective treatment possible. It's a means of eliminating the problem before it really begins. And if you can eliminate the need for the treatment and prevent the decay from occurring, to me, I think that is the wisest way to address the problem. And the other speakers have already summarized my comments that I have to say. So I appreciate the fact that this bill is being considered, and I appreciate the opportunity to come and speak. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions? No questions. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. For the record, I'm Willie Tiffany with the League of Oregon Cities, and we are in opposition to Senate Bill 1327 for a couple of reasons, and neither of these reasons address the issue of fluoridation itself. However, the bill does provide for preemption of local decision-making authority. Most communities over 10,000 in this state have had an active discourse on whether to fluoridate or fluoridate their water supply or not, and have for some reason or another either decided to do so or not do so, and this bill would preempt their authority to do, make those decisions. Secondly, the bill does also provide for an unfunded mandate on local governments, and that is a cost to us. The bill does provide for initial funding of fluoridation, fluoridating the water supply and initial costs, capital costs associated with that. However, it does not provide for the ongoing cost of maintaining that fluoridation, and that is a cost to local government that would be unfunded by a state mandate. With me today is Susan Snyder from the City of Portland to also testify on this issue.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I will be very brief. The City of Portland neither supports nor opposes fluoridation of our water supply. We don't currently fluoridate our water. However, we oppose the bill because we think the decision to fluoridate should be a local one. And this obviously is a mandate on urban areas only, and we'd urge you to oppose it for that reason.
Thank you very much. Sure. Senator Barrett.
Thank you, sir. Willie, do you know, have any idea what the cost is?
The initial cost?
No. The ongoing cost to keep it in once the equipment's in place.
The ongoing cost. Mr. Chair and Senator Beyer, on Friday afternoon, seeing this bill come up, I made some phone calls to some communities that do fluoridate, and approximately the ongoing cost per year could be estimated about $10,000 for chemicals, equipment, and then about a 15th of an FTE.
Oh, it's about $1 a year per citizen?
Depending on the size of the community.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, we estimate about half that, about $200,000 a year in Portland, so that would be about 50 cents.
Mr. Chair, if I could, in looking at this equipment, once you have it, it pretty much operates on its own, and you just put the chemical in, it scientifically measures it and puts it in the water system. So the ongoing cost is, as Willie said, if it's a 15th of an FTE a year, that FTE is moving pretty slow. It should take just minutes a day.
Other questions? Thank you very much. Appreciate your testimony. Close public hearing and open work session on Senate Bill 1327.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Chair Beyer.
Move Senate Bill 1327 to Ways and Means. If you do pass.
Senator Byers moves Senate Bill 1327 to Ways and Means to do pass recommendation. Discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Carnival. Senator Courtney.
Yes.
Senator Byers.
Aye.
Senator Miller.
Aye. Having received the necessary majority, Senate Bill 1327 is moved to Ways and Means of a due pass recommendation. We will, let's see, I saw a representative in the room. Is he still here? Don't see him now. Yeah. We're going from here. Well, I am going to jump around a little bit.
Mm-hmm.
I would like to go to, I guess we need representative start. Bill was
2683.
And that was.
You could bring ship back and people can.
Yeah, the problem is I don't have committee to handle the bill. So, let's see if we can get to contact us for this part I mentioned.
His L.A. was just here. Let's see.
What are we waiting on? What are we waiting on?
Well, we're waiting on Representative Starr. We're waiting on some committee members. We have opened a public hearing on House Bill 2683, Representative Krupp.
Good morning, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, I'm State Representative Jeff Krupp. Again, a pleasure to be in front of you. I'll be very brief. We have the B9 amendments to my bill, 2683, which is my Habitat for Schools bill. And I think we have satisfied everyone's concerns in my conversations with the individuals who were concerned about the bill previously. And if Bob, if you want to come on up, why don't you come on up we'll go through that briefly. And
thank you.
Basically, the B9 amendments address the issue of lease back, which is currently in our statute as it is today. It just clarifies it a little further in this particular circumstance. We're adding in on the second page, making certain that on line number 9, paragraph 5, any community foundation or nonprofit corporation that does not use all volunteer labor is subject to the provisions of ORS Chapter 279, and that should cover all of the public contracting laws that were the concern. And that was our intention, and hopefully we've achieved everything we wanted to do here with the bill.
Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, Bob Shiprack, Oregon Building and Construction Trades Council, also speak for my employers at this time as well. We now support with the amendments bill. The issue, I think the representative thought he had it done. I think there was a mix-up at LC over some issues. What the amendments do for us is where an entity goes out to contract for some work where they can't use volunteers, certain things simply can't be done by volunteers, that it would be competitively bid, and that way it also would guarantee to the community foundation that they're getting the lowest responsible price. I think it works for everybody, and so I'll be quiet and support the bill.
Thank you very much. Questions of the witnesses?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. We appreciate moving the B9s and moving the bill out. Thank you very much.
Thank you. You support the bill. Senator Courtney. You had a problem with the amended bill. Appreciate that. Public hearing and open work session on House Bill 2683.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Beyer.
Move House Bill 2683.
We've got to move the amendments first.
Oh, I'm sorry.
B9.
About those. Move the B9 amendments.
Senator Beyer's moved the B9 amendments to House Bill 2683. Any opposition? Not so ordered. Senator Courtney has moved House Bill 2683 as amended to the floor of the do-pass recommendation. Any discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Courtney.
Yes.
Senator Byers.
Aye.
Senator Miller. Senator Miller. And Chair Starr.
Aye. Having received the necessary majority, House Bill 2683 moves the floor to do pass recommendation. That was close that work session, open.
You want to name a carrier?
Oh, carrier for this bill. Senator Courtney will carry. We will open a public hearing on House Bill 3013. Representative Starr. Roger Williams. And Dorothy Carmen.
Good morning. For the record, Bruce Starr, State Representative, House District 3, testifying in support of House Bill 3013 this morning. This is the homeschool bill this session. We have worked long and hard on a bill this session. We've amended the bill, and we've worked closely with the School Boards Association, the school administrators, and the governor's office. Find a bill that we could pass and that would join in the governor's signature. In that work, we've come to what you have before you, I hope, the Task A8 amendments to House Bill 3013. This is very similar to a bill that was worked last session, but didn't quite get over the hill and get the signature of the governor. Just some minor changes that this amendment has to that bill that was vetoed last session. Basically, what we have is current law is that homeschool students are tested annually, report those tests to the Education Service District. There's potential there that the superintendent of the service district could remand the students if they don't score well to the public system. What we have in House Bill 3013 is an amendment to that homeschool law. Basically, the major change is that the homeschool students would only test at grades 3, 5, 8, and 10 unless they didn't score at the 15th percentile. We also, in the bill, have in there that if a student participates in extracurricular activities at the public school, that they'd have to test at the 23rd percentile, which is about the sea level, and that's an equity issue that was pretty important to the School Boards Association, because most of the public school students at this point have to score at the sea level as well to participate. So that was in the bill as well. At this point, I'm going to turn the mic over to our homeschool folks here. Allow them to testify. I've got a committee to get back to. I believe Danny Santos is in the audience here. If there's questions, he's from the governor's office. They support the bill. And I'd like to go on record now as thanking Danny and the governor's staff for working hard with us and finding the language that's agreeable, that I believe if we would pass this on, that the governor would sign. This is a bill that's significantly different than the one that passed the House on a broad margin that was a much stronger homeschool bill, would free the homeschool students' families significantly more than 3013. So I believe the DAC AIDS is a strong bill and a good step in the right direction. So at this point, I'll turn the mics over. I'll excuse myself with the chair's permission and get back to my committee work. And then I appreciate your support this morning. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Dorothy Carmen for the record. I'm a homeschool mother of 15 years, and I'm also on the board of the Oregon Christian Home Education Association Network. Prior to 1985, home education in Oregon was legal, but difficult in some locations. Families had to receive permission from their local school district superintendents, who sometimes made arbitrary decisions against homeschool families. Pastor Dennis Turi came to the Oregon legislature to request relief from the situation. He asked for the exemptions from compulsory school attendance for homeschooling to be similar to that for private schooling in Oregon, which requires no notification and no testing submitted to the public schools. Homeschooling was relatively a rare phenomenon in those days, and this body was unsure how well families would be able to teach their children, or even how many families would be interested in doing so. Therefore, the 1985 legislature wrote a homeschooling law that would be uniformly enforced around Oregon. It required both annual notification and annual testing. Now, after 13 years of keeping track of test results, the Department of Education records have consistently shown that as an alternative education method, homeschooling does very well. And you can see the 1997-98 results of that test in the colorful graph in the handout, showing that homeschoolers, the purple is the public school averages for the different percentile ranks, and the green is the homeschoolers. And you can see how homeschoolers tend to score on the high end of the standardized achievement test. Also, there's a graph on page 9 of the national study called On the Threshold that shows how homeschools compare to public schools. Every year, home educators have their children tested the standardized achievement test. Home educators bear the total financial burden for this testing mandated under the current homeschool law, in addition to bearing the total financial burden for teaching their children at home. This last school year, approximately 14,000 homeschool students took achievement tests for a cost to home educators of well over $500,000. All this was done in order to catch poor students who were slipping through the cracks, who were subsequently required to return to classroom education. If this were something that the state was paying for, I believe that you would consider $500,000 a substantial financial impact in order to require those four students to go back to the classroom. In addition, the educational service districts also expend considerable resources monitoring homeschooling. This adds up to a great deal of time and energy and money to tell poor families that they can no longer teach their children at home. The testimony you have in your hands, both for your edification and for the record, discusses our reasoning behind the request to remove home educators from the jurisdiction of public schools. After all, home schools are not public schools. The written testimony, however, also describes how we have moved from that position in our original bill to the -A8 amendment. The Oregon School Boards Association and the Confederation of School Administrators, many of whose members administer the homeschool oversight by the ESDs, agreed with us that annual standardized achievement testing was unnecessary for home education. With their help, we crafted the version of House Bill 3013, which passed the House by 53-5. It requires testing and notification once for each child's school career for the majority of home educators. After the strong bipartisan showing in the House, we began discussions with the Department of Education and the Governor's Office to address concerns they had with House Bill 3013. The results of the -A8 amendments you have before you. These amendments require home educators to take standardized achievement tests at grades 3, 5, 8, and 10, the same grades public school students take comprehensive statewide assessments. For the record, it is our understanding in discussions with both the Department of Education and Mr. Santos that this is not a move to require home educators to take the Oregon benchmark test at grades 3, 5, 8, and 10. The bill provides that the state, quote, the State Board of Education shall adopt by rule a list of approved comprehensive examinations that are readily available. In addition, the child is evaluated on the composite test score, quote, based on national norms. Home educators are interested in keeping as many options as possible for testing open so that we can choose the test that will most adequately reflect what we have been teaching our children. In summary, and in the spirit of cooperation and in the effort to lessen the burden of testing on homeschool families, we have worked with COSA, OSDA, the Department of Education, and the Governor's Office in order to craft the bill and amendments you see before you. It is our ultimate goal to obtain equity with parents that choose private school in Oregon, but because homeschools are not public schools. But at this time, we heartily encourage you to send House Bill 3013 with the -8A8 amendment to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Appreciate the testimony. Any questions? Senator Barr?
Are you going to comment?
Yes, sir.
Ms. Carmen, what is the primary objective to the annual testing?
There are several, Mr. Chair and City Manager. There are several objections. One is the cost. But beyond that, this is not, Canada's achievement tests were not designed as a pass-fail instrument for students. Publishers of the tests will tell you they are designed to assess how well the educational program, the type of education, the classroom setting, is achieving. So they're very good at assessing the overall educational program. How well is the classroom setting doing? Those kinds of things. But they are not well designed for assessing individual achievement on any one day. A child may be having a bad day. A snapshot picture does not give you a good assessment of how the child is doing. In addition, because there has been a cutoff point, a lower-end cutoff point placed on those standardized achievement tests, those children that are struggling with education and the ones that are in most of need of the private instruction that's provided in a homeschool setting are the ones that are being required to go back to the classroom or have the threat of being required to go back to the classroom.
Further questions? How many in Oregon, how many homeschool students remanded to the classroom last year?
Chairman Starr and to me, there were four that were remanded because of low test scores last year. Again, this is an awful expense for both the home educators and the ESDs to have to track to catch those four families.
Thank you.
And may I add, sir, that it is my opinion that probably those four students would be much better off at home anyway because they need the attention that they can get in a one-on-one situation.
Thank you very much.
Roger Williams. I'm with Ocean Network also. I gave you this handout. When the law hinders education, I'll talk about that in a minute. And I will be brief. I know you have a full schedule today. I'd like to emphasize the process that we went through here. This is this year is the first time in my knowledge in Oregon that we have had homeschoolers who are frontline educators, the school districts, meaning OSBA and COSA, who are frontline educators, and the Department of Education and the Governor's Office all coming to a common conclusion here on what would be a good bill. This has been teamwork between what were before, quite frankly, factions who were of an adversarial nature towards one another. So I'm very pleased at what we've accomplished in getting establishing these good working relationships, and this bill is the result of that. This bill is, as Dorothy pointed out, this bill is not where homeschoolers ultimately want to be. I'll be a little, I'm not trying to be confrontational here, but the children are ours. They're not the state's. I understand the state has some interest in how things turn out, but they are ours, and we have the most at stake in making sure that they are educated well and they turn out to be good citizens. And we would like that recognized, especially in light of the fact that we have proven that we are doing a good job educating the children. One thing that I was personally disappointed with, and I hope to work with more with the Department of Education and the Governor's Office on this in the future, is that the remand is still in the bill. My son, and I'm not going to read this, but basically what it says is it recounts how we have worked very hard with my son, who was at the lower end of the scale, And in contrast to my daughter, who is at the high end of the scale. But if he were sent back to public school because of a remand situation, he would be worse off. That's just, I just state that categorically. And so, in the future, I would like to see us move forward to no remand situation. But the overall thing here has been cooperation in between the various parties. I've been very pleased with that, and so I would urge your support of this bill. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Questions of the witnesses?
Yes.
I do. We've been there for you many times, Chair.
Thank you, sir.
You haven't been there for me particularly. Oh, that hurts. We have before a consensus bill, I believe, at this point. We've got nods from the back of the room. Bill that's been agreed to.
We have a work session.
We're going to close public hearing on the work session.
Move the dash. A8, is that correct?
Is that correct?
To House Bill 3013.
Senator Courtney has moved the dash A8 amendments to House Bill 3013. Any discussion, opposition, no opposition, orders.
Chair, I move House Bill 3013 as amended to the floor to do pass recommendation.
House Bill 3013 as amended has been moved by Senator Courtney to the floor to do pass recommendation. Further discussion, Senator Byer.
Yes, Chair, I'm very supportive of home schooling. I think that the majority of the people have done an excellent job. In fact, I thought most of the results that I've seen indicate that parents do a good job, and I think that's as expected. Obviously, people who are choosing that option care a lot about the education of the children. However, I can't support the bill for a couple of reasons. One, I think it's, whether we like it or not, the state has a responsibility, as stated in our Constitution, to monitor that education, and I realize that that is, to some degree, a conflict with parents' rights. Two, I think that the responsibility for annual testing is an important one. We should continue it. And three, I think, as I said in the prior two legislative sessions, the state ought to be paying for that test. We shouldn't require the parents to pay for that. It's the least we can do, since they're bearing the entire cost of testing with not putting any impact at all on the school system, even though they're still paying the taxes for that. I will not support the bill.
Senator Courtney,
state pays the test to
private. Does not.
For private schools.
Not for homeschoolers. That's paid their own fees.
And is it private school?
I don't know about that. No. The back of the room says no.
They don't pay for private schools.
No.
I don't think so.
And should for that too, probably.
We have before us the dash A8 amendment. Clerk, call the roll.
And you have the bill. You passed the amendment.
Oh, that's right. Excuse me. We have the bill before us. Clerk, call the roll.
Peter, I think so.
Call me.
Senator Byer.
No.
Senator Courtney.
Yes.
Senator Carmel.
Aye.
Senator Miller. Chair Starr.
Aye. I received the necessary majority. House Bill 3013. As amended, as moved the floor to do pass recommendation, the chair will carry. We move on. What do we got next?
Mr. Chair, are you going to carry Rule 2875?
We're going to carry House Bill 2875. Going to be carried over. To a future date. We don't have full committee here for that committee work session. We will
Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Question on that one, The only question I had, and I asked Representative Simmons and carried it, is whether the language additions in Section 1, Sub 3, that was necessary. I have no problem with the Section 3. I just wasn't sure whether the rest of the, whether it was needed to allow the hunting. I see them as different issues.
On the AN growth
side, if we could, whenever we have that, if we could have the Fish and Wildlife Department address that concern, whether they need that additional authority or not in that section.
Okay. Yeah.
Chair Starr, members of the committee, I think that Representative Simmons will be able to join us at a later date and answer that question.
His car is broken down.
Yeah.
His car is broken down.
At Cascade Lock this morning.
He's coming back from the cougar hunt?
He's coming back from the cougar hunt over in Wallace and
okay.
Well, that happens to be where he lives, and he's had a week on with his family, and he didn't make it back this morning. So that is the reason we're carrying that bill over, primarily.
I wanted to make sure, Mr. Chair, that we had some answers when it came up.
Thank you. I appreciate the question, and we will get answers for you. And and we got the rest of the front page, and we're over here. We're going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2585.
Members of the committee, 2585, you had a discussion on this bill in the middle of May, and Representative Mannix and the Government Standards and Practices Commission have come up with a -A2 amendment. The -A2 amendment clarifies when a public official will announce the nature of a conflict of interest, and that person would have to explain that conflict at the request of any person. And the amendment also clarifies that the public official does not have to announce the existence of the conflict more than once on any occasion at which time the matter is being discussed.
And we don't have any witnesses signed up for the bill. But we would, are there answered questions by the committee members? The quorum. We do have a quorum.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Byer.
My members are voting on this one. Thank you, Director of Questions, Staff. Is this changing it now? Do all announcements have to be in writing?
No, I believe that you can do it verbally also.
On the first, maybe it has to be.
Only upon the request of the appointing authority is this in writing.
In Section 1, Subsection C, that's the amendment.
Mm-hmm. Is this sure that will happen at a public meeting? Looking at the 15 on the hand and gross version, 15A through D.
Oh, the member would have to announce once during the meeting.
The question is whether this is in a public meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Where do we see that?
This is just applies to the legislature now. Chair?
Senator Barr.
I guess the concern, and I'm thinking of a couple of different levels here. One, because we're dealing with both local officials that have to announce, if I understand it correctly, as well as the legislature.
Mm-hmm.
And for local levels, and frankly, my thought process is around planning commissions, there are often a number of meetings that are held and not very well attended in some of the states where if someone were to announce something to sort of an empty room and meet the legal requirements, that would be different than when they got back in an actual public meeting, an official meeting when, you know, you're doing a public hearing. That's on one plane. On another, it's the legislature. Under this, could somebody announce their conflict, a member of the legislature announce their conflict in a committee hearing, and then not have to announce it on the floor also? If that's the case, I think that's problematic.
Sure, and some of the my impression of 15A through B is that each time the matter is discussed, the member would have to announce the conflict.
How does that jive with only having to announce it once?
Upon any occasion during which the matter is given rise to the conflict is discussed or otherwise acted upon.
That's right.
You discuss mention it once during your committee meeting, but I would think that you'd have to announce it on the floor also.
That's not clear.
You can talk to you some representative minutes for that.
Where did you just read from?
That's the situation now. You only have to announce it once on the floor.
So, Chester, Senator Beyer, are you thinking that the member would have to announce it once, whether it's in committee or on the floor?
You can have to announce it both times when you choose an action. But you could read, it seems like you can read this to say that if you announce it in committee, I'm going back to the testimony that Representative Mannix gave, and it's just from memory,
mm-hmm.
he was saying it's just an efficiency move to say that any time it was discussed, you don't have to announce it the first time the matter is discussed.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
I think we're reading of that new amendment, 15A through D there, indicates any occasion, once, only once on any occasion. So it does, in fact, say that if you are voting on or you are in public discussion of the issue, any occasion, you only have to do it once.
So you have to announce your conflict. Say you had two parts of a public hearing during a meeting.
I guess we should have had a lawyer here to help us.
I wonder if that might be helpful instead of any occasions we said at any meetings, and that would be clear. We could do just a
hand in gross and change occasion to meeting.
At any meeting?
Any problem?
Any public meeting?
I don't see a problem, Mr. Chair. I'm just trying to think of what may pop up. I don't think that pose a concern.
Who got the LC here? The draft of it?
We got the draft of the hand and gross.
Could we, Mr. Chair, if we could, maybe we could ask the attorney to draft it if you join us for a couple of minutes and just ask him.
Yeah, we'll recess this bill for the moment.
No, here. You guys are still moving. Don't trust anything.
Let's recess House Bill 2585. We'll open the public hearing on House Bill 2140. And as we can get the witness list. Mm-hmm.
that have a utility like that. And they just kind of get straight to you. You know, if you go to the government, you have to get them.
We got the board covered this morning. We got for, against, and neutral. Bill London, Bill Calder, and Barb Hutchinson. Get up here and let's see what we like about this and what we don't like about this.
Mr. Chairman, for the record, Bill Linden, representing the Oregon Restaurant Association and 7-Eleven Incorporated, here to testify in support of House Bill 2140. House Bill 2140 reflects a compromise piece of legislation that resulted from many hours of discussions between the package store and on-premise licensees, the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, and other various interested parties. The bill, as it passed the House, and it did pass the House on a unanimous 45-0 vote, does a number of things, and I'll run through them quickly for you. First of all, the civil penalty authority of the Liquor Control Commission is increased from $80,000 to $5,000. That means that in any given instance, the commission can impose a penalty of up to $5,000 on a licensee for violation of state law or commission rules. The bill also, in the Ingross version, requires employees who have sold alcoholic beverages to a minor or failed to verify identification to attend mandatory training programs. It allows the commission to impose a penalty on the employee who sells alcoholic beverages to minors, and that penalty can be up to $500. It would allow a package store licensee, that's a grocery store or convenience store, to install equipment that's designed to prevent sales to minors in lieu of being fined or otherwise sanctioned. So if a licensee were to have an employee who made a sale to a minor, in lieu of paying a civil penalty, they could buy one of the machines that are on the market that you run driver's licenses or other IDs through to verify age. And it also directs the Liquor Control Commission to establish what we're calling a responsible vendor program. The amendments to the bill that are in front of you today, the -9 amendments.
Mr. Linden, what kind of opposition did you have in the House, Mr. Bill?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Turner, there was no known opposition, and the bill did pass the floor on a unanimous vote.
And you have...
make the next move.
We can't, we're in a public hearing. We can't go to work session, but,
Do you announce it?
Because I, I haven't tapped the gavel.
Oh, I see. Okay.
That's the reason.
That's a very important reason.
But it looks like, we might lobby a good bill to death. And,
I think I understand the message.
You want me that.
Before we go there, what are the A9 and A10 amendments?
Yeah, let's tell us about which of the amendments we're talking about here and briefly.
Yes, sir. The A9 amendments, sections 5 and 7, expand the responsible vendor program to include restaurants and other on-premise licensees in addition to package store licensees. Section 8 of the A9s deals with training for on-premise employees, and it just simply, if you look on page 3 of the amendments at line 16, allows the commission to adopt rules relating to this training and provides that those rules shall include ways of providing alternative training to these employees. And that means videotape programs and other kinds of electronic media. Section 9 is our conflict amendments that relate to House Bill 2892, which is a comprehensive rewrite of the OLCC licensing laws. The dash 10 amendments, the A10 amendments, are simply conforming amendments in the event that Senate Bill 115 passes the Assembly. That is the gist of dash 9 to 10.
All right. We've got Bill Calder signed up in opposition. A9s and 10s, or Bill itself.
Yes, sir. I'm Officer Bill Calder of the Portland Police Bureau. I work in the Drugs and Vice Division. I work now full-time on liquor license issues and alcohol issues for the city of Portland. And I've been a police officer in Portland for almost 25 years, so I have lots of experience dealing with alcohol issues through my career. I'm here today representing Mayor Katz, Chief Moose, and my Captain James Ferraris. Minors drinking alcohol is a major concern for the city of Portland. You only have to read the newspaper or watch the news at night to figure out why we have too many tragedies with young people drinking. We are in very strong opposition to this to these amendments. In Section 3, Paragraph 1 mandates training for offending clerks.
Where are you looking at?
Okay, I don't know. I'm sorry, I'm not as familiar with these as some other people here because I'm down here as little as possible.
I appreciate that.
You don't love us? You don't love us?
Well, you have other things I'd rather be doing today, Senator, than be here, but here I am.
You do, Senator.
We're in pink. I am looking at Section 3 of the... Now, I don't know if mine's the most recent version, but when I got it up before. I don't know. She knows it better than I.
We need a bill.
Talking about mandate training? Oh, okay. Well, I'm looking at whatever she is handing. Pay and growth, Section 3. Second page on the back there. It mandates training for licensees and clerks who are caught selling alcohol to minors. We favor training, strongly favor training, but before they sell the first time. More training afterwards can be beneficial, but it doesn't mean they're not going to sell again to a minor.
Mr. Chair. Senator Courtney.
Yeah, he could interrupt, but, you know, because time's the best insurance. They don't get any training ahead of time.
Many licensees do not require training of their clerks. It's not a requirement.
So, you don't have any problems if they get training ahead of time?
Absolutely no problem with the training ahead of time. I wish they all...
You'd have no trouble with it if they got training ahead of time either, would you?
No, sir. Well, I would. If the problem with this section is it says each time they get caught, they can get training again to sell again, but it doesn't tell us how many times they're going to get to do this before they're told not to sell anymore.
Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair.
That's our problem with that, is the training is there, and the training is in lots of different facilities, and some of the training is even free, but they don't mandate their people get it. The training is not foolproof. I've seen several trained clerks still sell alcohol to minors. They're still going to make those human errors. In Section 5, Section 5, which is on the next page under age verification equipment, allows installation of high-tech equipment in lieu of a fine. Many stores already have this equipment, but it's only as good as the clerk who's using it. I know of at least 3 sales to minors where this equipment was used. The first one in the chain convenience store was where the clerk asked for the minor's driver's license. He put in the date of birth. The machine told him to refuse the sale. He put in it again. It told him to refuse it. Then he changed the year on the date of birth so the machine would say okay for the sale. So it was only as good as the clerk who was putting it in.
Senator Courtney.
You know, I do have to say this, officer, and I realize you're in a very tough line of work. You know, even police officers make mistakes. When you said training doesn't mean they won't make mistakes. Potential mistake is one thing, but no matter how much training you get at Western Oregon University, I'm very familiar with the police academy.
I didn't go there, but that's okay.
Okay, fine. Ongoing training, which maybe you don't have, or I'm supposed to get 45 hours every 3 years to be an active member of the Oregon State Bar, doesn't mean that I won't make mistakes. I'd like to know, if you do know, the magnitude of these types of people that are constantly making these mistakes, and whether or not it's intentional, because I don't think it's fair to say that if they have training, you won't then mistakenly. That happens, and I think you'd agree with that, if, you know, use a sort of broad brush approach here.
The problem is that we have the repeat offenders is the issue here. Mm-hmm. It's not the person who goes out there and makes one sale. Mm-hmm. We have several clerks that have made more than one sale to a minor decoy. And the chance of one clerk getting caught by a minor decoy twice is pretty slim when you think about how many clerks are out there versus our minor decoy program. And as I was going to say toward the end of this thing, we have over 600 package store licenses and about 2,000 total liquor licenses in the city of Portland. There is less than 20 stores that are even in trouble with getting up to four. Now, we're only talking a very small percentage here, but those small percentages are kicking out a heck of a lot of alcohol to our kids, and that's the issue. I don't know if you want me to continue, or we want to just do a question.
Senator Byer.
Is it the fines or the penalties are too low? Or, I mean, it seems like one thing is the employee, but the bottom line is, I would think, if I were OSCC, if I had a store that got busted two or three times, I'd yank their license.
The law that presently stands is the fourth time they may lose their license.
Fourth time?
Fourth time in a two-year period. They may lose their license. That's the current law. The law has been suggested to be changed where they can go up to six in a two-year period. Now, that hasn't happened yet, but I understand it's in the works.
That has to do with evidence of intent or sloppy procedures?
I'm sure all of those things are applied in different times. It just depends on the sale that's being made. The thing we're after is repeat offenders here, and I'm going to go off of this, I guess. The real problem we have is the preferred vendor program that the other gentleman was just talking about, which is in Section 7. What that allows is, after they go through training and equipment, which we already know is fallible, then the licensee can never lose his license for subsequent sales to minors. Never. What is the encouragement there to not to have your clerks be sloppy? There isn't any. This is the equivalent of someone being arrested for drunk driving and going to a class, promising to do a better job, and then we saying to them, okay, we'll never suspend your license for another drunk driving arrest, no matter how many. This is the same thing. We're having people sell drugs out there, and alcohol is very definitely a drug, with no big hammer by the Liquor Commission where we can't take their license away. The City Council has said, our Portland City Council has said before on three different occasions that they want licenses taken away after four sales in 2 years. The city is going to maintain that level regardless of what the state says as far as our recommendation to the State Liquor Commission. We're always saying that four is enough. We think four is enough. The problem is that if this goes through, it doesn't matter how many, and the city comes back to the Liquor Commission and says, we're going to go unfavorable on this renewal, and the Liquor Commission says, too bad, we can't cancel for sales to minors, so they're going to keep their license. It makes the City Council's recommendation completely moot. It doesn't matter what they say then. But we're not trying to close down liquor licensees. We're just trying to get them to quit selling alcohol to our kids. That's the bottom line. I don't want to close people. I know a lot of the licensees. I deal with them daily. I'm not trying to close their businesses. And most of them do a great job, as you can see the figures. We've done several hundred stores, some of them as many as 10 times. And several of those stores have got no sales or maybe one sale. The great majority has very small amounts. It's only a small percentage out there. And I don't think that this law is going, we don't think, the city doesn't think that this law is going to allow for that big hammer to hold over their head anymore. A $5,000 fine to Southland Corporation is nothing. But a drunk kid is a big problem.
Senator Byer.
Yes. Officer, I just want to...
Sure.
try something with you here. My assumption, and I guess I'll ask OLCC, having discussions with them different times on issues in my community, is that I believe the reality they believe they're faced with is inadequate enforcement staff. They can't go out and do much. I suspect the reason this bill might be here is to sort of a carrot, saying if we can get people through the safety of saying if we do all of this stuff right, we can't lose our license. The idea means that maybe rather than the enforcement, it'll be a stronger way to prevent sales. Do you buy any of that?
I think the mandatory training would certainly be helpful, and the equipment's going to be helpful. It's probably going to reduce some. But the problem comes in is what is the, where's the stick end? The carrot's wonderful if people will take the carrot. But you still have to have a stick behind it. And I've seen licensees get into major trouble because, frankly, they don't care. And I don't want to see that. I think, especially the big corporations probably care, but then by the time it filters down to the clerk who's standing at that register for the eighth hour, they're not paying attention to what they should be doing, and it just goes. And, of course, we do have purposeful sales. We've had a couple of those documented where they're on purpose. And the licensees have certainly had problems with that, but that's the time to get rid of the clerk and make sure you've got good people in there.
Further questions?
Well, Mr. Chair.
Senator.
I've got some problems with the officer's testimony. For one thing, I think that the enforcement of a minor getting alcohol is the responsibility of everybody, not just the licensee, not just the clerk. It's also your responsibility as a law enforcement officer.
Yes, it is.
And pass that buck off to other individuals, I don't think that is really the proper way to do it. Do you find, if in your thinking, should we not approve this bill or just give it to where it is right now currently?
The sections that I have, especially Section 7 is the big section for us, the preferred vendor program.
Do you agree with the philosophy, with the overall philosophy that you're trying to attain with 2140?
Well, I don't agree with the compromise idea. The bill that this was replacing, as I understand it, we have some major problems with that one as well, but I think the philosophy of more training is good, and like I said, we need to mandate that training. But then saying it doesn't matter whether the training works or not, you know, you're not going to be in any trouble, we don't think that makes any sense. I mean, if the licensee cannot hire good people and cannot train them properly, then he shouldn't be in business. It's still a privilege to own a liquor license in the state of Oregon, and we're giving it away as a right in this case. Once the person's got enough money to put in a program and train his people and buy the equipment, it becomes a right. We can never take that away from him, so it isn't a privilege anymore. It's a right. We don't think that's good work, good tactics.
Excuse me, I'm going to interrupt because we have a representative here who's got a lot of work to do, I know. And we should hear from him, and then we'll let you continue.
Thank you very much, Senator Starr. I'm Tom Butler from House District 60, which represents Mount Huron, Lake, Harney, and half of Klamath counties in southeastern Oregon. I'm here to testify on behalf of 2140, House Bill 2140, and it is, in fact, not a privilege vendor program, but in fact a responsible vendor program. This bill encourages responsibility, both in pre-training and in follow-up training when there have been difficulties. Now, only one corporation has been named here today, and I'll go ahead and follow up on that corporation. The name of that corporation was Southland Corporation. Southland Corporation has some rather extensive pre-training that's mandatory for their employees. And I would say this relative to other large vendors of alcoholic beverages, such as the national corporations, which sell beer and wine at retail package outlets within the state of Oregon. Many of these have very extensive preliminary programs. These are being encouraged by 2140, and they actually reward additional training by encouraging them, these companies to continue with those training programs. Now, one thing that has been missing is the carrot and the stick issue in the past, and that is the licensee gets damaged every time an employee can violate the rules. And what one thing it does is that that these employees maybe get sloppy, and when they get sloppy, then as they go ahead and enter a phony ID or enter in a false birth date, as has been indicated by the officer from Portland, then what it does is it starts to take part of their wages away. Now, I submit to you that it doesn't take very many $500 fines to an employee, directly to an employee, before they're not going to be able to find or not going to want to continue in that particular industry, and they're not going to be able to find jobs and locations near their homes to be able to continue on in that particular line of work. And we believe that this is a responsible vendor program which helps identify those youngsters or those younger employees or employees who could be intimidated into selling to youngsters. Now, in the process of developing this, we also went through a number of hours of budget hearings and meetings on the budget issues to see what we could do to incentivize various agencies, various existing selling package stores and so forth to incentivize them to do exactly this, and that is continue the training and then start to nail those who would intentionally violate the law. And what happens is in the majority of these companies is once there's a sale by an employee, even a tenured long-term employee, not only is that subject, that employee then subject to potentially the fine by the Oregon Liquor Control Commission, but usually they're faced with the loss of their job. And as they go to seek for a new job in a similar location somewhere else, not only having been nailed for $500, they'll also have that as a black mark on their record because that follows them. But then they are offered opportunities for training, and that training opportunity is, again, an issue of part of a responsible vendor program. Now, I recognize also that training may be sans one employee that's no longer there, but it takes away from the, what it does is it substitutes the cash fines that have been previously coming into the agency. It substitutes first the opportunity for them to enhance and expand their training program for all employees within the organization. The second thing it does is it incentivizes them to go ahead with the electronic age verification equipment. Now, this is in lieu of the current $1,000, up to $1,000 fines that we've been talking about, and then what it does after that is it starts to nail them. Now, we have some pretty good testimony on record that says, hey, wait a minute, you're talking about nailing an Albertsons or a Safeway or a Lucky Store or Fred Meyer or Oscar Myers, or Fred Meyers, I guess what it is, Oscar Myers or Fred Meyers, you're going to nail us $5,000. We're not very happy about that. Well, that's after they have had an opportunity to put in the swiping machinery. Now, in our DMV budget for the hearings that we've encouraged for the Department of Transportation, we're also encouraging the DMV to use the magnetic striping to convert our licensing over to magnetic striping, as well as OLCC on their programs to encourage the magnetic striping, so that magnetic striping machinery, which is uniform in most of the other states, I think Oregon is one of only a handful, less than 10, that presently does not use the magnetic striping for actual identification on driver's licenses, so that this machinery becomes much more standardized and becomes much less expensive. And so what we're talking about is we're talking about an attempt to bring some uniformity into the age verification equipment. Incidentally, if after that machinery has rejected the card swipe, or a youngster has underage youngster has attempted to purchase the machinery or to purchase alcohol and has had the actual identification swipe through the machinery, and we find out that the machinery has identified that as a minor, then it's going to require an additional employee to come in and turn off the machinery, basically a two-key operation to say, wait a minute, shut it down. You've got someone here that basically either has false ID or who's attempting to purchase alcohol at a minor age. And so this is an attempt to try and get those youngsters that are acquiring somewhere between, we've had testimony that somewhere between 7% and 8% bottom end and a high of nearly 30% top end have been able to acquire alcohol in legal locations illegally. And we feel like that if we can stop that much of the flow of alcohol, then that's a good start. That doesn't mean that the other somewhere between 92% to 70% won't get it somewhere else if they're really anxious to get it, but at least it stops it from the retail stores. And so I just bring that carrot and stick issue to you. There's no law that we can implement on the books that mandates honesty nor integrity. The only thing that we can do is that we can hope that a $500 fine, which is well more than a week's salary for one of these types of employees, is going to give them enough cause for pause that they'll stop and say, hey, wait a minute, I'm not going to get involved in this. The question is four times enough? Do we want to get tougher? Yes, we'd like to get tougher, and we'd like to do that by incentivizing, again, those folks, giving them an opportunity. We've heard in our budget meetings that there are some very difficult situations with full suspension hearings. They go on for long periods of time. There's lots of appeal rights. They're very difficult, and we feel like that 2140, as it's presently implemented or as it's presently presented to you, with some opportunities for the budget notes to start to take effect so that we can get more uniformity amongst our card striping equipment, and then using that as, again, a responsible vendor incentive to get them to get the equipment, and to first of all get training mandatory up front, secondary training for all employees, and then finally getting equipment in lieu of cash fines, and then eventually going through the fine program very rapidly to the point where they're at $5,000 fines. And we feel like that this is a very excellent method of incentivizing and encouraging responsible vendors for alcoholic beverage in those legal locations.
Have you had a chance to go through the, I think there's four amendments to the bill?
Chairman Carno, I have not, members of the committee, I apologize, I have not since it left the House, since it was presented and passed at the House. But I will get a hold of those.
Any further questions? That's me. It's in the culture. There's nines and the tens. I get the sevens and the eights. I've heard from those folks here on that. Any further? Thank you very much.
Thank you. Very kindly. I appreciate your patience and kindness. Thank you.
Let's hear from the LCC from April.
Senator Tarno, for the record, Barb Hutchison from the Oregon Liquor Control Commission. I'll just point out a couple of things that I'd be happy to answer questions. First of all, with regard to the amendments that you have before you, the commission doesn't have any problem with those. One, specifically...
Which amendments are you talking about?
The nine, I believe, am I right, Dan? The nines and the tens are now what we're looking at, mm-hmm. And not the other two.
The six, sevens, and eights were combined and put into the nine.
Some of these are just conflict amendments. The retail licensees were left out of this bill initially, and that was an oversight on all of our parts. And the other part generally deals with looking at the training that's offered. It's mandatory training for all servers and bartenders. It's been in existence since, I believe, 1986. And with technology being what it is today, it's always good for the commission to look at that delivery system, and that's all that amendment asks us to do. It doesn't make us change the way we deliver the training, but it does get the commission to look at possible new ways of doing that. Moving on to the bill now, this, in fact, was a cooperative work piece, if you will, between industry and the commission. That came about as a result of our budget negotiations, and Representative Butler was very helpful, I think, in in getting all sides together to talk our way through this. I think he's also correct in saying that this is a carrot and stick sort of situation. The responsible vendor program will, in fact, be worked out in detail through a public rulemaking process. We don't know what all the pieces of it are right now, but I would like to point out that, generally speaking, when a manager or a licensee is a poor manager and a clerk or someone who works for him or her sells to a minor, generally speaking, that manager is going to make a number of other mistakes as well. From the commission point of view, we would rather have a licensee keep a clerk who has sold once to a minor. Generally speaking, we find that that clerk will not do it again. But generally speaking, and Bill can correct me if I'm misspeaking, that most licensees fire the clerk when they have sold. The Liquor Commission did introduce a piece of legislation this session that would have required training of all clerks up front before they could sell beer and wine out of package stores. That bill, unfortunately, did not even get a hearing. This bill gives us an opportunity to at least get at the clerks who have sold, and we can run them through some sort of a training program. If they, in fact, lose their job over the sale, we will have a record of that person, and a responsible licensee can call the Liquor Commission and see if that clerk's name appears on a list as having sold alcoholic beverages to a minor. I might also point out that a poor licensee will probably make other mistakes besides having their clerk sell to a minor. The commission still will retain the authority to fine and suspend a license and for other violations to cancel a license when they get up to a certain point. So I'd be happy to answer any questions.
Mr. Chair, Senator Barr.
Mm-hmm.
It looks like the one key thing that we're doing here is allowing the commission to fine an employee of a package store. Similar, it looks like it's similar language to what you have on servers, right?
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I believe that's the case. The Liquor Commission, are you talking about like in a bar, a tavern? Or?
I think that's what it is. I'm looking at Section 1, Sub 2, that talks about increasing the fines to establishments, but it also goes on and talks about to the service committee, which I assume must be a server.
Yes, that's correct.
That fine in that case is as it's not less than 25 or more than 500, and my question would be, practice of OICC, how many of them have been at towards the 25 end versus the 500 end?
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chair, Senator Bayer, I'm not sure I have those details, but I could get them for you.
The implication here is that penalties of up to 500. And I think that was the testimony, and some is that you're not going to get too many 500. President Butler class said $500 fees. I'm just wondering if how many of your fines are $500.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, I don't have those numbers, but I think this bill specifically is speaking more to the increased fine to the licensee if a off-premise clerk sells to a minor. We can now fine that licensee $5,000 rather than just $2,000.
Currently, you can't fine the person who actually sold the beer or wine.
Mr. Chair, Senator Beyer, we can cite them civilly.
We have two different kinds of people we're involved with. One is the service permittee in the Section 1. I found the section you were just speaking of. That's only for on-premise sales. They have to go through a mandatory training and get a service permit.
That's in a bar.
In a bar. But in a store, a convenience store or whatever, there is no permit process, and there's no permit for the clerk. So there has never been any fines by the Liquor Commission
against those employees.
They may get a state court fine when they're cited into court, but that's up to a judge.
So this just makes it easier and quicker in terms of the commission can fine them directly without going to the court.
I don't see anything here where it talks about the clerks at stores being fined through OLCC. I don't see where. Is that in here and I'm missing it?
I'm just looking under
Section 1.
Section 3.
Oh, Section 3.
Sub 8. I thought that's what that was about.
Okay.
Civil penalty under the section may not exceed $500 in this section.
Yes. That's the employee.
That is changing. Yes, it does add them then in that section.
That's what Representative Butler was saying, that the big difference here is the ability to go directly into the employee, which is the biggest disincentive.
If there's no further questions, we're under real time problems. Do you have you'd like to move the bill along with the dash A9 and A10? So I'm going to close the public hearing, open the work session.
Mr. Chair, I'll move the dash 9 amendments to House Bill 2940.
Senator Tarnow has moved the dash A9 amendments to House Bill 2140. Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Tarnow.
I move the dash A10 amendments to House Bill 2140.
Senator Tarnow has moved the dash A10 amendments to House Bill 2140. Any objections? Hearing none, so ordered.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Tarnow.
I move House Bill 2140 as amended to full defense recommendation.
Senator Tarnow has moved House Bill 2140 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion? Or call the roll.
Senator Meyer. Senator Courtney.
Yes.
Senator Miller. Senator Tarnow.
Aye.
Chair Stone.
Aye. Have received the necessary majority. House Bill 2140 is moved to the floor with a due pass recommendation. We've had a request as a carrier. Is that in truth?
Sure. Do another
Senator Tarnow will carry. Thank you very much. We're going to open a, and we've got Representative Mannix here on House Bill 2875, is that right?
2585, Mr.
2585, okay.
Good morning, that Representative Chuck.
Good morning. Open a public hearing on House Bill 2585, and we've got a couple of other ACM-4. Okay. We'll get to that shortly.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Representative Kevin Mannix from Salem. You previously had this bill up, and you heard from the Government Standards and Practices Commission, they had some suggested changes to this bill, and we did compromise with them and work out some language which are in the dash A2 amendment. These make some minor modifications to the bill to address concerns expressed by the Standards and Practices Commission. And Patrick Hearn, who is the director of that commission, sent me a fax on May 21 forwarding the suggested language. And this is basically his confirmation to me that we had talked and that this covered the needs of the commission. And so I'm in front of you this morning encouraging the adoption of the A2 amendments to House Bill 2585. And with those, we have a bill that does not have any objection, as I understand it, from the Standards and Practices Commission.
Senator Barr, I had a question that you may be able to answer.
Thank you, Mr. Representative. I'm looking at the A and gross versions, and I'm down, I think it's... I guess it would be the line 7 to 11 of the bill. The question that comes up is if we're talking about either, and I realize this applies to both local governments or government commissions as well as the legislature, the notion that you only have to announce the conflict more than once upon any occasion, language there, does that apply to once the bill starts for example, if we were talking about a bill in this committee and one of us announced a conflict of interest, does this require or preclude their having to announce it again when a bill comes up on the floor?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer, actually this provision will not apply to members of the Legislative Assembly. It's in a separate subsection of the statute, and it's a little confusing in the way that it's set up, but if you go back to page one of the AIM Gross bill, you'll find that sub 2 of ORS 244.120 starts out at line 21, an elected public official other than a member of the Legislative Assembly. And then it goes on. So this does not apply to members of the Legislative Assembly. The standard practice of announcing a conflict each time you're voting would still apply here. But there's another interpretation by the Attorney General as to how that process works, and really the conflict of interest announcement for legislators is really subject now to rules of the House and rules of the Senate.
Let me raise it then in terms of, and I was thinking, this is a member of a planning commission, but it could be a city council or a public commission, where they may be talking about an item over a number of different meetings. Do they have to, does this imply that each meeting they have to announce their conflict with the items being discussed?
We set occasion, if I may, Mr. Chairman, Senator Beyer, because that is a word of art which has been used for years in the statute. The current law talks about, if you look at the original bill, you can actually see some of the current law where we're taking out the phrase at one point on the occasion, which, but we're using occasion again because, frankly, that is a slightly broader term. For example, it is technically possible that a given board or commission may meet one morning at 9 a.m., adjourn, meet again at 11 a.m., adjourn, meet again at 3 p.m., and you may have the same people present throughout the day, and you would then probably be allowed the generous interpretation that throughout that day, that was the occasion. And if you started the day making your announcement, it would run through the day. A public official is being careful and would probably want to make that announcement at each of those separate meetings. But there are times when the term occasion will actually allow a little bit extra flexibility, and this is a term of art that's presently in the statute, which is why it was used in the amendment.
Thank you very much. We're going to close the public hearing and open work session on House Bill 2585. We need to move the dash two amendments.
I'll move the dash. Did you move it?
Me too.
No, I didn't
move the dash two amendments to House Bill.
Senator Courtney has moved the dash A2 amendments. Any objection? Hearing none, so ordered.
I move House Bill 2585 as amended to forward the two pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney has moved House Bill 2585 as amended to the floor of the two pass recommendation. Any discussion? Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Meyer.
Aye.
Senator Courtney.
Yes.
Senator Miller. Senator Carnell.
Aye. Aye. Having received the necessary majority, House Bill 2585 moves to the floor of the due pass recommendation. Carrier. Senator Courtney will carry. HCAM 4. Open the public hearing. Invite Senator Chelms and Representative Patrick.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. For the record, my name is Gene Timms, State Senator from District Number 30. Last session, I had a Senate memorial on this issue on the adjudication of the Klamath water rights. This session, Representative Patrick introduced a joint memorial to Congress, which relates to, as far as I'm concerned, since it's in my district, I guess, but not because it's in my district, because it's important to save water for Oregon and make sure that the water is adjudicated properly in that future water use. It is a very important issue, and of course, Congressman Smith, who was the congressman at that time, I was involved in it with him, who tried to get the federal water rights that are associated with that adjudication paid for by the federal government. Well, we haven't been able to do that. The Water Resource Department's on board. we have had in our budget, which very few things have been in the budget as we've gone along, as many of you know, $1.1 million to continue this program of adjudication. And I am certainly hoping that we'll see that happen in the near future. But it's an ongoing process to save Oregon water and a very important process. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
I just add for the record, I'm State Representative Rob Passage. I represent House District 50, which is basically the city of Medford. The reason we introduced this legislation is for many years, people in the federal government had discussions about diverting the Columbia River water to California. That discussion was taken seriously by Senator Mark Hatfield, that he actually introduced legislation in the United States Senate that forbid any diversion of Columbia water out of the state. And the argument is always held that Oregon's water right is a state's rights issue. In the last half dozen years, the Bureau of Reclamation, at the insistence of other, including the Department of Interior agencies, have circumvented the longstanding operations plan in the Klamath Basin by diverting Oregon's water to California for interests other than agriculture. Not only do Oregonians own Oregon's water right, but the United States government, I feel, has no standing to illegally allocate this resource. Oregon has recently begun the adjudication process in the Klamath Basin, which will determine the ultimate priority. Until that legal action is completed, the federal government, we believe, must adhere to the water claims that were negotiated in the early 1900s. When the adjudication process is complete, all the parties, including the federal government, will have a clear legal right to utilize that water from the Klamath Project. This resolution, House Memorial Number 4 in the aid engrossed version, sends a strong message to the President of the United States, Secretary of the Interior, and Congress that we will not give up our historic water rights in the Klamath Basin and allow our local farm families to be heard. This memorial urges the federal government to continue in good faith the adjudication process.
Thank you very much. Questions? Thank you for bringing the issue to us. We call Martha Pagel and Doug Myers.
Thank you. Chair, members of the committee, for the record, Martha Pagel, Director of the Water Resources Department. I mainly just wanted to be here at the resource if you have any questions about the background on the adjudication or the issues that are raised in the memorial. Please, the department don't typically comment on memorials as they are really your expression of the legislature's point of view on the issue. We do support the active language of the memorial. Some of the recitals, we did work with Representative Patridge on the House side and appreciated some changes that he made at our request, primarily to make sure that all of the various balance of interests were reflected in the recital portions of the memorial, and we do appreciate changes that were made, particularly to address the tribal issues. With that, I'll just be here to answer any questions or provide any background.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm Doug Myers, and I'm here representing the Klamath Tribes. We have some problems with the first memorial, and we still have a bit of a problem with the idea of a memorial as such because of the dual process that is going along with the adjudication, which is a legal determination of pre-1909 water rights. There's an alternative dispute resolution. Oh, no, that's not right. It is. Led by Ms. Pagel, Director Pagel, that gets all the parties together, the tribes, the irrigators, the federal government, and we talk and try to come to some resolution as to settling this without going to court. And if we can do that, it'd be a win-win situation for everyone. The tribes have a water right from time immemorial. That's a pretty ancient water right, and it's got farmers in the basin worried. The tribes are willing to take less water if the water can be cleaned up. So at the same time this is going on, there's a real effort through the Department of Ag's 1010 process and the DEQ setting of total maximum daily loads along with this effort. And hopefully we can come to some sort of a real win-win situation without everyone ending up in court for years and even decades. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you very much.
Questions of the witnesses? I'm going to move it. Close the public hearing, open a work session on HJM4.
There aren't any amendments, were there, Mr. Chair?
No amendments.
Move HJM4 forward to pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney has moved HJM4 to forward to pass recommendation. Discussion. Hearing none. Clerk, call the roll.
Senator Meyer. Senator Courtney.
Yes.
Senator Millen. Senator Connell.
Aye.
Chair Stone.
Aye. Having received the necessary majority, HJM4 has moved the floor with the due pass recommendation. Senator Carno will carry. And Senator Barr was excused. Close the work session. Open a public hearing on next measure, HJM6.
You're going to trouble with me on this. So, you know. What's here? You're
going to trouble
with me on this.
I am?
You possibly could.
I can't believe that.
In fact, when you say that, it's as good as I've been, Mr. Chair.
Okay, I appreciate it. I appreciate how good you've been. We have signed up only one witness. Is that right?
Maybe.
As far as I know.
George Buckner, O, D, F, and W. George.
Good morning. For the record, my name is George Buckner. I'm Wildlife Division Assistant Director, Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife. The Oregon Department of Fish and Wildlife supports House Joint Memorial 6, which asks the Director of the Fish and Wildlife Service to refrain from listing the Canadian lynx, as a threatened species in Oregon. There have only been 14 verified lynx specimens recorded in Oregon since 1897, and these records are...
1897?
Yeah, 1897.
I'm sure we'll get this straight.
I better put your glasses on, maybe I'll... Yeah, it has been since 1897. And these records are considered to represent animals dispersing from areas further north during peak population cycles. And they're only considered to be occasional visitors to the state.
Any, I guess our administrator can tell us what the House Joint Memorial 6 proposes to do, is just ask the department.
I request the federal government to refrain from listing the Canadian lynx as a threatened species in Oregon. Based on the idea that the lynx is in Oregon.
Is not a...
That's right. There are no breeding populations here in Oregon.
No breeding population. Hasn't been for 100 years.
We have not verified any breeding populations in Oregon. That's correct.
So... No one signed up in opposition to the bill. Okay. All righty. We're going to close the public hearing. Open my first session on HJM6.
I move House Memorial 6, Mr. Chair.
Senator Tarno has moved HJM6 to the floor to pass recommendation. Senator Courtney has indicated that he will give us a courtesy vote. If you want that on the record, I guess it's on the record now. I ask the clerk to call the roll.
Senator Meyer. Senator Courtney.
Yes.
Senator Miller. Senator Sarnold.
Aye.
Chair Stone.
Aye. I received the necessary majority. HJM6 moves forth to pass recommendation. The chair will carry this one. With that, we're going to adjourn the...
I'm going to come back here at 3 o'clock. Is that the idea, Mr. Chair?
Not a training.
Fine.
This is what I'm about to say. I'm going to judiciary.
I got judiciary, too.
And I'll
tell you, come back here?
5 o'clock.
Same place, right?
Same place.
Maybe it's right here, then.
All righty. Thank you.